Case number 14-6, sorry, case number 12-1461. First Energy Service Company Petitioner versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Shepard for the petitioner, Ms. Kafer for the respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is John Shepard. I'm here on behalf of First Energy. I've asked to reserve 3 minutes of time for rebuttal. The question at the heart of this case is whether FERC may dismiss a complaint under FPA Section 206 on the ground that the challenged tariff has already been accepted by the Commission as just and reasonable under FPA Section 205. FERC's realignment order announced a new rule, the first time in this case, that FERC will not entertain the merits of a complaint in under FPA Section 206 when a utility joins a regional transmission operator, because in FERC's view, the new entrant must accept the RTO's tariff as is. Under this new policy, changes in the receiving RTO's tariff will instead only be heard if the RTO itself submits a change under FPA Section 205. That holding is unlawful on the face of the Federal Power Act. To say it is to know that it is wrong. It denies the very reason that FPA Section 206 exists in the first place, which is to set aside pre-existing tariffs. It also defies this Court's sound holding, Your Honor, Judge Sintel's holding, in Atlantic City, that FERC may not force the utility to give up its statutory rights as a condition for joining an RTO. FERC's orders never confront that argument. Instead, FERC presents two fig leaves to cover the unlawfulness of what it's done here. FERC's first line of defense is to say that this has always been its policy. But our pleadings and our briefs clearly demonstrated that that is not true.
Well, aren't you challenging the application of Schedule 12? Isn't that your burden to show that that would be unreasonable as applied here, that unjust and unreasonable?
Yes, Your Honor. It is our burden under FPA Section 206 to show that the application of Schedule 12 to us in this particular instance is unjust and
unreasonable. And so how did you meet that burden?
Let's do a little history. The year before First Energy made its application, Duquesne proposed to leave PJM and go to MISO, the opposite exchange. This revealed the curious problem that by doing so, Duquesne would leave all the transmission costs in PJM behind and assume no new ones when it joined MISO. FERC identified this problem when the PJM transmissioners were alarmed by it and said, well, PJM, you, in the Duquesne withdrawal order, you should adopt MISO's policy so that you're not faced with this sort of situation. Then we had ICC, Seventh Circuit, decide that the pro rata cost allocation under Schedule 12 had not been supported by FERC even for existing members. So with that background, we filed, based on FERC's latest guidance, that when faced with the opposite situation from Duquesne, where we're not paying zero, but instead we're get the 180-degree opposite result, where we're going to be paying for both, so 200% more, that we should pay one and not pay the other. We reasonably submitted, based on the most recent guidance from FERC and from the federal courts, that the right way to resolve this, if we're only going to pay for one, was to pay for the facilities that were planned with our participation and for our benefit in MISO. There was a reliance interest there. And not pay the sunk costs of the PJM transmission owners.
Is it your contention that there would be no benefits that would come to you from the PJM sunk costs?
Well, let me challenge your premise, because I think where you're headed is the idea that if there are benefits, then you should pay for them. The test is not whether or not there will be some benefits. The test is whether or not the benefits are roughly commensurate with the rate that will be paid.
Well, so there will be some benefits, we assume there.
There will perhaps be some benefits. And Your Honor, this is the second half of my constructive, but it is important to understand that the rule against sunk costs, which is a key important argument that we made in our 205 application and in our complaint, which FERC completely ignored until we threatened them in our rehearing request with per se remand for failing to respond to the core of our case. The sunk cost doctrine doesn't exist except as a response to the beneficiary pays principle. We know that there are going to be benefits whenever two systems join. They may be more, they may be less. The sunk cost principle says, okay, fine, there will be some benefits, but you guys plan to build this system before these other guys ever decided to join. You made that decision independent of any expectation that you were going to be paid for it. This is the first half of ICC, sticks with this principle. This court considered the very same principle in Wisconsin, where when MISO was forming, they formed in 2001. They didn't make their cost allocation, their cost sharing proposal until 2004. But ATC said, you know, we know this cost allocation sharing plan is on the table, and we're going to go ahead and decide to build some things. Then, when they sought cost sharing after the cost sharing proposal was adopted, this court said, you know, FERC, you're right. They built that with just an empty expectation that there was going to be cost sharing. They decided they were going to assume those costs on their own, and there you are. And this is not some bizarre notion. I mean, this is a rulemaking of FERC's since 1994 in the transmission policy statement. It was confirmed in Order 890, neither of which authorities FERC has ever even acknowledged are involved in this case.
What's the violation of the statute? Because at the end of the day, I guess you would have to show that the tariff is in breach of the statute in some fashion. The violation of the statute if FERC just says, there's some stuff out there about sunk costs, but it seems rational to us to base the group of entities who are going to pay for the costs that we've already decided are going to be incurred based on how you benefit on a going forward basis?
Well, Your Honor, if they had come back in the realignment order and said, you know, we're not sure what the benefits are, why don't we set this for hearing, then that would have been a rational response. In fact, it's FERC's usual response when there's a material dispute over relevant facts. Here, they didn't say that. The realignment order says, tough luck, we already approved this under Section 205. That remains the core of their rationale in their rehearing order as well, although they do finally respond, at least to some degree, to our sunk cost argument. But let me turn to a third major issue involving sunk cost, and that's the Entergy case. This case was pending on rehearing for 3 years, quite nearly 3 years, and we were already in PJM for 2 years by the time they decided to spring this beneficiary pays rationale on us for the first time. And they did so without even acknowledging that before rehearing even issued, they had just issued the Entergy decision, and Entergy is going into Midwest ISO, and they say, wait a second, you guys just approved $5 billion worth of multi-value project cost allocation, the biggest cost allocation you've ever done. There was no glimmer in anyone's eye we were joining and did that. We shouldn't have to pay for that. And FERC says, you know, you're right. We're going to give you a 5-year waiver for any of the stuff that was previously approved before you arrived. So the notion that the rule against sunk cost allocation is somehow perverse is just wrong.
So what at the end of the 5 years, I take it that that entity couldn't have to pay.
Yes, it could have to pay.
So, but as I understand your argument, it would be a perpetual immunity.
We have asked for perpetual immunity, and we'd be willing to have a hearing as a second step. But I also want you to understand, and we represent Entergy and we represent First Energy. That's one of the reasons why we're so incensed that having cited the same exact cases in two different proceedings, we get the same result. And in the Entergy case, we talk about it as the ATSI realignment principle, this idea that now you're going to have to go out and get a 205. Why do you end up with a 5-year waiver instead of a permanent waiver for sunk costs? Because FERC has taken away the 206 hammer. They already told us, look, if negotiations fail, tough luck. We're not going to hear you under 206. You have to negotiate a compromise with these guys under 205. And this court should be very familiar with the complexity of the entry negotiations into the Midwest ISO, because only last week you issued your decision in Southwest Power Pool. It wasn't just a question of, will we go into Midwest ISO? Possibly going to the SPP. There was this complex 3-way fight between the states over which was the better way to go, which was not the way to go. But FERC certainly did no help to voluntary choice in joining RTOs when it said, you know, if your negotiations fail, don't think that you're gonna need a relief under 206. We don't want to hear you unless you're gonna get a 205 filing. And what's interesting here is the presumed beneficiaries, the guys that you think you would presume for protecting, they're the PJM transmission owners, the ones that already exist. What did they have to say about this? Item 4 in your joint appendix is the PJM transmission owners pleading. Is there anything there saying that we're wrong on the merits? No. Their only complaint is that you filed under Section 205. We think you should do it under Section 206. They guarantee us, and I could point to the specific page if you wish, They say in page 12 of their pleadings, fourth item in the JA, bottom of JA-151, they raise the very same point. It's okay. You should negotiate with us. If the negotiations fail, you can always still file a 206. Indeed, they point out in JA-143 and note 9 that section 7.3.3 of the PJM Transmission Owners Agreement not only allows all existing members of PJM to file a section 206 against the RTO, but preserves that right for anybody else, namely us. All they wanted us to do was file under 206. And they couldn't have argued that we were wrong on the merits because half the people in the indicated PJM transmission owners were already challenging Schedule 12 in the Seventh Circuit or on remand from the Seventh Circuit's decision, and they're back before them again in the Seventh Circuit's second remand, which is now pending about halfway through briefing. I'm not sure when we're going to have a oral argument in that case. But, Your Honor, did I answer your question about why this is a statutory violation?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me return to my original script in the absence of other questions. I'd like to discuss the fact that FERC's notion that this has always been its policy is just simply false. And then their secondary retreat to the idea, after we showed them a long line of cases where there were always changes to gaining RTO tariffs, that, well, in the past what we've done is we've approved waivers, but we haven't approved what you're asking for, which they call removing a tariff requirement entirely. That, again, is also false, and that quibble is just wrong. The Alliance and Great America cases, which we discuss at length on pages 39 to 41 of our brief, are excellent examples of wholesale changes to tariff changes imposed under as a consequence of RTO maneuvers. I mean, very dramatic changes, including the elimination of through-and-out rates, the elimination of mobile Sierra protections for a variety of pass-through costs. You can refer to our brief if you want specific details. We've already discussed Entergy, another powerful example. What does FERC have to say? Everything that FERC says to try to distinguish that precedent confirms that they are wrong on the law. They say with respect to the 206 cases, well, you know, we initiated those 206 cases. The entity involved didn't. They filed a 205, and we responded by requesting a 206. Well, that's fine. But what the statute says is that private companies can file 206s, and as an alternative, FERC can act sua sponte. So the idea that FERC can arrogate to itself the unique power to proceed under 206 is simply false. Secondarily, and I've touched on this point a little bit already, the idea that we should be required to have to join in a 205 not only destroys bargaining power, but it's irrational, because what are you to do if your negotiations fail? Your only recourse would be to proceed under Section 206. You're left with nothing else. And finally, it's not even clear that FERC really means it when it says, you know, we'll be happy to proceed to entertain this under Section 205. But there is no doubt that PJM supported both our initial application and our complaint. That is clear in the face of PJM's position. They say, look, this is ambiguous. FERC, your interpretation that you issued in dicta may not be plainly wrong, but that is definitely not our intent. This is designed as a reallocation mechanism for existing RTO members. It was never designed to address new members, and it certainly wasn't designed to address the bizarre circumstance here where they're going to pay for MISO's legacy costs and PJM's legacy costs.
If we disagreed with you about the ambiguity and thought this was plain, we wouldn't be looking to intent, would we? FERC's never done that. We don't do that, right? So the issue is whether this is ambiguous or not, right?
Well, the main issue is did FERC give reasoned consideration to our 206 or just deny it? A secondary issue, if you want to address the tariff, is whether or not the tariff is ambiguous. FERC's opening order, the realignment order, takes a position that it's really clear that this is what's going to happen, but as we explained in the reply brief, the rehearing order does not take that position. In fact, in the very passage where it is saying we don't care what PJM has to say about the tariff, they say we're not going to be bothered by the fact that there's a lack of express language applying this to a new entrant. I think that there's plenty of ambiguity about that. Is FERC's interpretation in some later case, because it's not this case, because they didn't address it, going to be upheld on Chevron Step 2 grounds? I don't know. But if you'd like to talk about the mechanics of the tariff, then quickly I will cover them in my next minute and a half. 12A says that responsible customers are going to have the cost reallocated to them on an annual basis. So you then have to turn to what the definition of a responsible customer is. That is defined a little bit later in 12b-7. I don't think that we put it in the appendix, although this came out in moots. They said, well, you should provide that. It would have been helpful. It's easy to find on PJM's website. And what it says is that a responsible customer is an entity that PJM determines in its annual reallocation process is going to be made responsible for these payments. They have to file a Section 205, and there's a 30-day period where you can contest the fact that you've been designated as a responsible customer, or you can contest the allocation that PJM has given you. So the idea that there is a tariff and that's the end of the story is not the case. And again, let me fall back to ICC. What is the Seventh Circuit's position about this pro rata cost allocation mechanism? The Seventh Circuit says it's not even been shown to be just and reasonable for existing members of PJM. It follows a fortiori that if it isn't even just and reasonable, and FERC hasn't shown that it's just and reasonable in its own self-imposed Section 206 proceeding, that pro rata cost allocation makes sense. Here, you've got these big projects people proposed in 2005 and 2006. They're spreading the cost all the way across PJM off to Chicago. And we think the benefits
what
are
do you,
here.
Can I ask one question? What do you think is the effect of the Seventh Circuit, the pendency of the Seventh Circuit case for this case?
That's an excellent question, Judge Srinivasan. Several people asked about that when reading this.
Please repeat what you just said.
Yes, Your Honor. Judge Srinivasan asked if what is the effect of the pendency of the Seventh Circuit case, and my answer is it's limited. The Seventh Circuit is going to decide whether or not FERC has on remand presented enough evidence that it can justify the cost allocation that it imposed under FPA Section 206. I'm in that case and intend to defeat FERC on that ground. In the event, however, that FERC prevails, we're still in a fundamentally different position, which is why we've always talked about sunk costs. We are not the same as an existing RTO. We were not there in 2005. We were not there in 2006. We are not located east of the Alleghenies. Power flows are all west to east.
What if we prevail?
If we prevail, then FERC's going to have to go back to the drawing board, and it's going to have to decide whether or not the DFACS analysis, it's something called the DFACS is short for distribution factor analysis, whether that was a better way of doing things than pro rata load share.
But if you prevail there, what would be the effect for this case?
If we prevail there, then the effect for this case would be, well, Schedule 12 has still not been shown to be just and reasonable. It's still in litigation, and we're in a better position than anyone else to escape these legacy transmission costs. And I shouldn't use escape. I should say avoid. We've been paying for PJM's transmission system ever since we joined, and for everything prospective. We paid for everything when we left MISO. We've been paying for everything approved by PJM going forward. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Okay.
All right. I apologize for going over.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Holly Kafer for the Commission. If I can start at the beginning, the Commission did address FirstEnergy's 206 complaint on its merits. It did so, obviously, in more detail in the rehearing order, but that's what the rehearing order is for. What the Commission found and what puts FirstEnergy in a different position than some of the other utilities that have changed RTO membership is that they didn't satisfy their burden to show that application of the same methodology to them as a transmission owner as applies to all of the other PJM transmission owners is unjust and unreasonable. Others were able to satisfy that burden, and others filed under 205, and there is a distinction that matters there that is drawn by the statute. The Commission under Section 206 has to do a two-step. It must first find that the tariff is unjust and unreasonable. As I mentioned, they didn't satisfy that burden. When others come in, like Entergy, under Section 205, the Commission does not have to do that first step. It skips directly to whether the proposal before it is a just and reasonable replacement. This Court has often cautioned the Commission, or often enough, that we can't skip to that second step when we're acting under 206, and that's exactly what the Commission did here. They stopped at step one and said, we cannot find this as unjust and unreasonable. As Mr. Shepard mentioned, there are, I think his words were, perhaps some benefits from the PJM existing transmission facilities to First Energy. And that alone is enough to require First Energy to pay for those facilities under this court's precedent and the Seventh Circuit precedent.
Is it a scintilla rule if there's any benefit that's sufficient, or is it commensurate benefit?
The Seventh Circuit has used the roughly commensurate phrase in their recent precedent, but neither this court nor the Seventh Circuit has required the commission to exactly match costs utility by utility, which seems to be what First Energy is seeking
First Energy says they're seeking that something be roughly commensurate. Are you saying it doesn't have to be in any sense commensurate, even roughly, or are you saying that any benefit is enough?
Certainly, the prevailing rule is that it needs to be roughly commensurate.
Does the commission give us an analysis that would support this being roughly commensurate in this territory?
What the commission found with regard to the existing facilities in PJM is that the benefits of those facilities may change over the lifetime of PJM, of the facilities, which is exactly demonstrated by First Energy joining PJM, that it will now benefit from those facilities. The facilities were planned to reach and benefit all of the PJM members, and precisely the extent to which anyone benefits is what's pending before the Seventh Circuit right now. So how the methodology works is what's pending before the Seventh Circuit.
What's the best part of FERC's opinions below that describes in what way this benefit is in any sense commensurate with the imposition on the entering utility?
The rehearing order at paragraph 26, JA-261, is where the commission discusses, and it does so generally, and that's because, as First Energy has said, and that's the language that I mentioned about how the benefits change over the lifetime of the facilities, and that the facilities were planned to benefit the entire region.
I didn't read that paragraph to be making a point about whether it's commensurate, because I thought what that paragraph was addressing is an antecedent question, which is whether somebody who wasn't part of the equation when the project was initially approved can nonetheless be liable for some of the costs on the theory that they're going to benefit. Just ab initio, it's just that question. We're not talking about whether the amount that's allocated against them matches up with the amount of the benefit, or asking an antecedent question. And I didn't read FERC in any of its materials to address the commensurate question, but I thought that the reason FERC didn't do that is because you didn't perceive there to be a challenge on that basis. But am I wrong about that?
The commission made an effort to, in light of, in particular, the pendency of the Seventh Circuit case, addressed that there would be some benefits to First Energy, but you're correct that it focused on the argument before it, which was based on the sunk cost policies. In fact, First Energy, even in their reply brief before this court, actually says that their cost causation claim is not based on a benefits test. That's in their reply brief at 20. Throughout the case, it hasn't really been clear to us to what extent they're pursuing that. And I suppose that makes sense because, really, the benefits question is pending before the Seventh Circuit. Here, the only question is whether, on another basis, First Energy should entirely escape from these costs that it acknowledges it will, to some extent, benefit from. And again, on that question, First Energy had the burden because of the position that they were in, and they just didn't satisfy it. And that's how we distinguish the Entergy case as well as some of the other cases involving RTO transfer.
Is there a case that's close to this one and that involves an entity who wasn't on hand when the project was initially approved but then is allocated a share of the cost?
Uh, Well, in Entergy, after 5 years, or that it'll be a phase-in of the sharing of the costs.
It might be, potentially. I guess we don't know at this point, but or do we?
Right. Well, I think the Entergy case has been decided. I don't know whether it's pending appeal.
Is Entergy inconsistent with this case?
I don't think that it is, Your Honor, because Entergy came forward with a proposal under Section 205, and I realize that FirstEnergy is frustrated by the operation of the statute, but Entergy did not have to show that the existing transmission cost allocation was unjust and unreasonable. FirstEnergy had that burden here. So that we don't know in the Entergy case whether the Commission necessarily would have found the existing provision unjust and unreasonable. It didn't have to reach that. Moreover, the Entergy decision, as Mr. Shepherd pointed out, was actually decided well after the parties had submitted their request for rehearing before the Commission in this case. I think the first Entergy order just came out a few months before the rehearing order in this case. So the Commission didn't have that before it when it was deciding this. But really the key there is that, in other words, it hadn't been presented with argument based upon that case. But really the key is that here the Commission had to address whether it would be unjust and unreasonable. The First Energy did face significant opposition from other transmission owners, from state commissions, in seeking this exemption. And you can find that, let's see, I apologize, but I think it's important to have that before you in light of Mr. Shepherd's argument. Seemed to suggest that everybody was on board with this, and it's at JA 211 where the Commission discusses the significant opposition that there was to this, as you can imagine, to this escaping of costs they acknowledge they'll benefit from.
Can I ask you the same question that I posed to the other side, which is what, in FERC's view, is the implications of the pendency of the Seventh Circuit case for this case?
The Seventh Circuit case deals with what FirstEnergy will be subject to as a result of this case. So it's sort of the broader umbrella, if you will. If the Commission prevails in the Seventh Circuit case, that methodology that has been adopted there and that's on review will be applied to FirstEnergy just like it is to all the other transmission owners. If it doesn't, then I think, as Mr. Shepherd suggested, it'd be go back to the drawing board. And I'm not certain, of course, how the Commission will handle that. I think that the key distinction between this case and the Seventh Circuit case, though, is that that's where the benefits question really is pending, and FirstEnergy is pursuing it there. In particular, the arguments that they raised for the first time on reply about the question of flows between East and West, all of that is pending before the Seventh Circuit. On the question of waiver, I can address that if the court likes. The Commission did grant a waiver here where FirstEnergy showed that it could not comply with the capacity market requirements because it had missed the deadline, since that's an advanced market, and it offered something in support. This is not like that. This is just seeking to escape from costs. As to the tariff language, the Commission, before FirstEnergy filed its 205 filing here or its 206 complaint here, had in the Duquesne case that Mr. Shepherd referred to already enunciated what it thought this language meant, and that is that new entrants would be required to pay PJM's regional existing transmission costs. So FirstEnergy was certainly on notice of what the result would be. There are no further questions. Thank you.
How much time does Mr. Shepherd have? Give you 2 minutes.
I'd first like to point out that it appears that the government has abandoned its initial theory in the realignment order that it's allowed to go ahead and boot you unless you file a 205. Because I just want to hear Section 206. I would like to point to paragraph 39 of the rehearing order, which is the only place they've ever bothered to even try to respond to our statutory argument. And what they do is they shove it into their statutory argument. We also reject, this is all we ever get in the statutory fight. We also reject First Energy's assertion the ATSI realignment order denied First Energy's request to revise Schedule 12 as applicable to ATSI based on the Commission's erroneous adherence to its own precedent. That's it. That nebulous mess is all we get for trying to resolve a very important statutory question. Now let's turn to the quickly to FERC's suggestion that we were actually heard the merits. No, we weren't. They've just shown you they didn't want to hear anything we had to say because it didn't proceed under FPA Section 205. There is no reason or response to our position. They just said no. Everything else was a rearguard action trying to distinguish precedents that we cited, try to address the sunk cost argument, but there is no actual answer to that question. Answer your question, Judge Sintel. Some benefits is not the test. It is not a scintilla test. It is a roughly commensurate test for the Seventh Circuit. It is a similar test to the KN Energy. KN Energy, in this case, in this court, was the case that originally set that.
What was our terminology in that case? What was our terminology?
The terminology, normally I have this immediately at hand, must reflect to some degree the benefits actually received by the customers who must pay them, I believe, is the right terminology. Taxing my memory a little bit there, Your Honor. There is no exact match test. And importantly, the court needs to understand this. When you talk about the balancing of benefits and so forth, no one who joins an RTO, no matter what value they bring to the RTO when they join it, ever gets paid a penny by any of the pre-existing members for what they bring to the system. The principle at issue here is exactly the same. It is just in reverse. ICC says this. Wisconsin says this. We know that nobody ever gets a cent for anything it brings to the equation when it joins an RTO. All this case is that principle in reverse. Okay. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted.